Hi, this is Circe Olson-Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tijeras, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, At Ease. I'm happy to be talking to two people today from Middle West Press. Some of you guys may know them. I have publisher and Middle West Press founder Randy Brown and associate editor and poet Lisa Stice on the podcast today. I'm so excited. So welcome.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
So Randy, I'm going to start with you. You're an Army veteran and also an Air Force brat. And reading your bio, I see as a kid, you lived all over the world. Like you lived in Travis Air Force Base, California, Yokota Air Force Base, Japan, Patrick Air Force Base, I guess that's Florida, Wright-Patterson Base, Ohio. So that's quite a variety. Did you have a favorite?
Well, I need to tell the brief story that Yokota, Japan was all of 8 months. The Air Force told us that we were going to live there for 4 years, and our family got there. And when my dad was signing into his unit, the question was, hey, it's great that you're here. Why are you here? So my mother had, of course, sold all the household goods and all that. And it's to this day, it remains a big moment in the Brown family's life of the changeover of all the belongings and all that had to occur during that time. Florida was probably my favorite in the abstract. I was there during grade school, during the bicentennial, all these great things. Dad was flying as a navigator on EC-135s, supporting probably the mid to late Apollo missions, doing telemetry. I joke that if the family had stayed there, I probably would have turned out a completely different individual. I would have been tanned. I would have learned how to surf. I would have been a totally different kid. I'm very pleased and proud to have ended up in the Midwest. But you know, in some alternate reality, there's a Randy Brown that was from Florida.
So speaking of the Midwest, so Iowa. You've put down roots there. Why Iowa?
Well, when navigator jobs got fewer and fewer, Dad mustered out of the active duty Air Force in the late 1970s and moved back to the Quad Cities region of Iowa and Illinois. There are seven Quad Cities, I joke. It's where the Mississippi flows east to west. In Iowa, on the east coast of Iowa, so to speak. Mom and Dad had originally met at Augustana College in Rock Island, Illinois, just across the river. So it was kind of a homecoming for them. My younger brother and I say that we got the best of all worlds. We got to move around and meet new people and see new places and have that kind of experience. At the same time, we also were very fortunate to graduate from a high school where we had started high school. I got out, or the family got out of the Air Force when I was in sixth or seventh grade. And so I had junior high and high school experience all in the same place. I consider Davenport, Iowa, a hometown, even though technically,
Rats going out.
Exactly.
Okay. So I know you've worked in newspapers and magazines, and now you are a freelancer as a writer and an editor, and then you founded Middle West Press. So what drew you to journalism, and what led you to start your own press?
Well, that's a good one. I was very active. My high school had a very a nationally known newspaper program. I kind of fell into that. I figured that even though in the late 1980s, I knew I was going to be a dinosaur when I decided to major in newspaper journalism. I just never thought I'd live long enough to actually see the asteroid hit. I enjoyed my time in newspapering. I got to work in what we called new media at the time. This is when we had dial-up modems and our computers were 9-inch screens, and we were learning to set type and all sorts of, I really had a foot in both worlds, pasting up newspapers with glue, and then later on, you know, the magic desktop publishing. So from there, I went to various magazines, national trade and consumer magazines. I ended up working for a rather well-known company based in Des Moines, Iowa, of all places, that has to do with making one's homes and gardens better. Mm-hmm. And my expertise, other than military, is also in writing about home repair and home design and construction and technology and those types of issues. Much to the dismay of my wife, who thinks that I continue to experiment on the house and not get projects done.
I was just going to ask you, you must just be able to fix everything and not have to worry about it.
Well, yeah, that's my problem. I think I could fix everything. And so that means that I at least make the attempt. So in 2003, I had a surprise military deployment come up with my Iowa Army National Guard unit. Mm-hmm. I thought I was going to Iraq. I ended up in Egypt. There's a story there. I'll tell that later. It was a good time to go freelance for my magazine job. Mm-hmm. And so I set up Middle West Press as my freelance writing and editing business. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until 2015 where I began to do launch into publishing services. And then I figured there's no better way to learn to do something than to do it yourself. And so I started publishing books to see if I could do it. And that business kind of took off.
Well, so how does that work? Do you have your own building where there's a big printing press, or do you publish on someone else's equipment? I mean, how does a publishing business work nowadays?
You know, I was lucky enough to go into newspaper. My first job out of college was to work for a small community newspaper in southern Iowa that still had its own presses. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So I've actually worked on mechanical presses and caught newspapers as they were coming off and bundled them up in string and pushed them out. And mm-hmm. It was an all hands on deck kind of situation. Everybody from the front office came back and worked the presses. So I've been lucky enough to do mechanical stuff. Mm-hmm. Today, the technology is such that you can send a file off to a printer, and that book doesn't exist until somebody actually wants to buy it. Mm-hmm. And when they buy it, the book is magically made and printed and sent. And so that publishing on demand or print on demand is the way that I continue to keep my marriage together, because that means that I don't have stacks and stacks of books in my basement or garage.
Right.
That I need to sell.
Or inky fingers. Yeah,
exactly. And it's always a fresh copy. You know, you don't have to worry about it getting dinged up or bent or whatever. So
okay, all right. So Lisa, you and I have never met, but you and I have collaborated on our museums together. We serve the Modern Military Spouse exhibit. So I wanted to thank you for that. You submitted several quotes from your poetry books and told me to choose some. And so I picked one especially. This one really resonated with me. It's from your book, PCS, Permanent Change of Station. And that was coincidentally printed by Middle West Press. So I want to read a little bit of that, because this just tickled me. Now we understand we're permanently changed. That can be counted on. And we change often. And what I loved about that was the ridiculousness of permanent change, you know, PCS, and, you know, there's no permanent change in the military.
Right.
Yeah, I could tell that you did too. So what prompted that particular poem?
Well, first off, I want to thank you for including me in the Together We Serve exhibit. Mm-hmm. And and that poem came, the whole book, and that poem was that I felt like the perfect segue, like beginning to that book, because we had recently moved with our 2-year-old daughter from San Diego, California to Hampstead, North Carolina. I mean, they couldn't be two different places. And we moved from my parents being a 5-hour drive away to being a full A's plane right away. And, you know, it was like, it was quicker to drive, you know, from Nevada to California than it was to fly, you know, from here to my parents in Nevada. But, and so it was just dealing with all those, just not the, just the move, you know, and that I, that changing of, you know, that of course, the irony of the permanent change of station with the PCS, because I mean, the, you know, it's, we know that there's going to be another change again coming up soon, and there's always the possibility of it. And, but being used to this place that was so different from the place that we came from, moving away from family, and then at the same time, having a 2-year-old who couldn't understand what was going on, mm-hmm. and who was changing so much, you know, daily herself. And you know, it was just a lot, a lot to handle at that time. You know, it was like,
yeah, well, you could either channel all that stress and anxiety and rage into bad words, or
exactly, yep.
or into poetry.
Exactly.
So
a little bit of both.
Yeah. So Lisa, you're a Marine Corps spouse. Did you have any military connection prior to marrying into the Marine Corps?
Little. My my grandfather on my dad's side was in World War II. Uh-huh. And he was kind of an older parent. He was in his 40s when my dad was born. So, mm-hmm. And he really didn't talk. I mean, he talked a little bit. I know that he spent time in around like New Guinea and Australia, mm-hmm. in that area. Mm-hmm. And, but he actually didn't really talk a lot about it. And then my, on my mom's side, she has some cousins and some uncles who were in the Navy. They're from Kansas. So I guess the natural thing to go from the middle of the country is to join the Navy so that you can, yeah. so you can see the coast.
Yeah.
So she has some who were in the Navy, and one who went Navy to Marine Corps. And when he was in the Marine Corps, that was a cousin. He was a drill instructor. Mm. And then a great uncle who was killed during World War II, who was in the Navy. Mm. But yeah, so those are my connections. They're kind of, you know, not in my immediate family, but some tendrils out there.
Yeah. Well, so that was my question. So what was the hardest thing for you to do? Because you were a teacher when you met your husband.
Right.
So what was the hardest thing doing marrying? What was the hardest thing for you to marry into the Marine Corps?
I think it was just getting used to, or the clash between what I expected versus reality, you know, because I only have those tangential connections. I, you know, my true, or what I thought was the true military, was mostly from movies and TV shows, you know. Right. I don't think watching Gomer Pyle really is, you know, maybe in some way a true view of the Marine Corps, but not for a spouse. Yeah. And so, and it's just kind of like, you know, some of those surprises of like, wow, it's a lot more disorganized than I thought it would be, you know, or,
disorganized?
Well, I mean, in the way that, I mean, from a spouse perspective, it seems like it is, because I know it, you know, it's really like, you don't know what's going to come up, you know? And so like those last minute, like, oh, well, I'm going to training, you know,
right.
Tomorrow, you know, to me, it seems like disorganized, but it's like, you know, things come up and I don't get to know what's going on. So all I think is like, gosh, I can't think I planned this ahead of time, you know,
yeah.
But, you know, well, it's those things.
And Lisa, wasn't your first collection, which was published by Aldrich Press, called Uniform, wasn't that? Yeah, a lot of that was just the kind of the various shocks that you felt.
Yeah. Well, and that was the biggest one, was the support to the spouses. And that varies, I found later, from unit to unit and battalion to battalion. But that was my first experience with it, really. And because my husband was at, when we first got married, he was an instructor at OCS. And so that was kind of a small, weirder kind of environment, you know. Mm-hmm. And then we went to a larger battalion in San Diego, and we did have a family readiness officer, but while the Marines were deployed, one of the spouses from my husband's unit died unexpectedly in her sleep. And that was just, you know, it was, and we got contacted by our husbands, who were off on deployment, you know, thousands of miles away. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, oh my gosh, you know, she didn't have a child. She had a dog. And then, and they didn't find out she had died until 3 days after she had died. Her husband had been trying to contact her. One of the other spouses, luckily they had a Rhodesian Ridgeback, so they had a big dog door. One of the other spouses crawled through the dog door and found her
dead
in her bed, oh, and the dog by her. And so we didn't know what had happened. And I thought, oh my gosh, not only do I have a dog, but I have a baby, because my daughter was 6 months old when they left for deployment. And this was only a couple months into the deployment. And the family readiness officer never got in contact with us. We never, you know, got offered counseling. You know, we were just kind of like lost altogether. And it was the first time that we really came together and talked with each other, the spouses, because it wasn't a very, I don't know, cohesive community there. And we were just like, you know, just like lost. And we, you know, went to her funeral. Her husband came back, and her family came to San Diego, and they had a funeral there, and we all went to it. And I mean, we just didn't have answers. It turned out later that she had a congenital heart problem that she wasn't even aware of. And then another spouse died during the deployment from another unit, and the FRO finally reached out to it. That was during it was just an appendectomy that went wrong.
Oh my goodness.
And yeah. And so the FRO finally reached out to us and said that she was going to have a meeting for anybody who wanted to come and talk about things and stuff. And then he scheduled it and then canceled it. And I just felt so abandoned, you know, and felt like, you know, here we are, like totally scared and thinking, you know, this could have happened to any one of us. And several of us have children. And what would our kids have done if, you know, we hadn't been found for 3 days? And
And as a military family, you're always thinking of, you know, that the risk is on the deployed spouses.
Right. Yes.
And I'd forgotten those stories. I thought you were going to tell the story about the wedding with the arch. When I was talking about shocks, I thought you were going to tell that story.
that deployment, that was my biggest shock. That was, I almost lost it at that point. And I'm not sure I really have recovered from.
Well, for people who are not in Marine Corps circles, what happened?
With all of the stuff with the spouses, or
with the ceremonial arch at the wedding. What happens in that tradition?
In that tradition, so you have however many Marines can come to be part of the arch. They come with their swords and their dress blues, and they form two lines so that you walk through the center of them. And they put the swords up as you walk through, form this little arch, and then at the end the last Marine swats the soon to be wife on the backside.
Nice. Gosh.
And says something like, welcome to the Marine Corps, ma'am.
Yeah, and it's like, yeah, welcome to the Marine Corps is what it means.
Wow. Hey, well, at a different segment in this podcast, I was going to talk about spouse anxiety. So we're going to come back to the conversation.
Yes.
But let's move on to I needed to ask Randy something really quick. So Randy, I read that you embedded as a civilian journalist, and you alluded to that a few minutes ago, with your former guard unit when they were deployed to Afghanistan. So was that a voluntary assignment, or were you called up to do so? I'm not really familiar how the National Guard works.
So So my family and I were on alert for first Iraq and then Afghanistan very late in my life, late in my career. And we had spent 2 or 3 years preparing for a deployment, and kids had just been born. So I had young kids, we were preparing ourselves, you know, legally and emotionally and physically for dad to be away for a year. And about 10 days before we were supposed to we were loading our duffel bags onto the truck to get sent off. And it was everybody load your bags, Brown, not so fast. And there had been a glitch in my my paperwork, and they figured out that because of my time, I would have retired halfway through my deployment to Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And so that they said I could go, but that I would, they first thought that I could go. And then as soon as my boots hit the ground back in Iowa, I would be retired, but that fell through. So I wasn't able to go with my unit. I'd done all the training and gotten ready to go and all of that. I was transferred to a role where I got to support my old unit, and I kept freaking my buddies out by showing up in uniform and places like Camp Shelby, Mississippi, and Fort Irwin, California, mm-hmm. In various support roles. And it was on the back end of a Humvee, sitting with the brigade commander who had been walking the line saying hi to the troops, and then saw me waiting to go into the box at National Training Center, Fort Irwin. And I said, you know what? Well, first off, he thought that I'd figure out a way to make this into a Better Homes and Gardens story, which I said I would turn it into Better Hooches and Gardens, just for him. And then I promised him at the time, just kind of saying it out loud, that I would figure out a way to somehow come to Afghanistan and see him and my buddies, what they were doing in Afghanistan. Because I had begun a military blog at the time. My Army job had involved blogging. Blogging was a big thing in 2007, 2008, 2009. Mm. And learn by doing again. So I had created a military blog, and I had, because I was doing it in off-duty hours, I needed a pseudonym. So I took on a nickname that somebody had given me in uniform, Sherpa. And I promised him that I'd come visit him in Afghanistan, and I figured out a way. I used all of my wife's airline miles to get me to Dubai, and then hopped a charter flight from Dubai into Bagram shortly before the unit was coming back. So I got the full picture. I got all the training. I got to see what the brigade was doing. 3,000 of my Iowa friends and neighbors, teachers, lawyers, police officers doing the job. Then I told myself that I'd, you know, continue to tell that story and whatever in those stories in whatever way possible. So
I read a little piece that you wrote, but could you read us how you felt smack in that war zone? Because I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, I think I know the piece you're talking about. That was actually prompted by my brother. I had left for Afghanistan. I sent an email to various family members, and my brother had, he may not remember this, but he called my wife and said, why did you let him go? And so I've been kind of wrestling with that question a lot in my writing. So the essay to which you're referring kind of addresses that a little bit. Mm. And this is from an essay called Battle Site Zero. And there I was, a middle-aged, middle-class city boy from Iowa, now stuck between ground and sky, smack dab in the middle of historical events and in the company of friends. Things had gotten very zen. I had chosen the middle path. I had found myself at war, but I was not in conflict. Buffeted in the air, focused on my breath, I was centered, zeroed, and on target.
So your reference to Zen and war at first seemed a bit odd, you know, I think, but then I thought about it, and people can find the spiritual in conflict. As a matter of fact, in our publication, E Pluribus Unum, we quote a Marine Corps chaplain who says that the smell of cigarettes before battle was holy incense. And if you don't think Vietnam, Iraq, or Afghanistan are holy places, you're wrong. It's where we die and we receive redemption. And so the spiritual in battle. And so I was interested in knowing your take on the Zen part of that.
Well, I really like your chaplain's words there. And I guess I have the philosophy, I probably stole it from an English professor, that there are only two stories in the world. Mm-hmm. There's a hero goes on a journey, and there's a stranger comes back to town. and a military deployment to me involves both of those things. Mm-hmm. I guess with an addendum that, you know, a hero goes on a journey, a stranger comes back to town, and they spend the rest of their lives trying to figure out what that all meant. Mm-hmm. And so reading my own words back to me, reading my own words just now, I recognize that, you know, I find myself smack dab in the middle of historical events and in the company of friends. And so much of the, you know, I characterize my work at Middle West Press and elsewhere, particularly as Charlie Sherpa, as being kind of veterans lit advocacy, veterans literature advocacy, you know, trying to find different ways of telling stories of military experience. And everybody has, and not just veterans, everybody has an experience with the military, even if you're just a taxpayer or a voter, but particularly if you're a family member. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea that we need to complicate the narrative beyond American Sniper, beyond SEAL Team 6, to, you know, the everyday, the mundane, the routine, really is important to me. What I find, you know, where I find my Zen is in the company of friends, and I found my company of friends in veterans, but I found in military family members, in my fellow war poets. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's my Zen, more than the smell of cordite in the morning. You know, that's where it is.
Well, so several of your essays also talk about when you were a little boy, you were grappling with the desire to go into the military, but yet you were very cognizant from church or Sunday school that God said, thou shalt not kill. So as a second grader, you took that very seriously, and you almost didn't go into the military. And so several of your writings from the combat zone, you know, because I've read several of your blogs, reference that memory. So how do you reconcile war's possible or actual killing and the biblical thou shalt not kill?
Well, as a second grader in Satellite Beach, Florida, the thing that most kept me from thinking that I would pursue a career in the military, in addition to the trying to reconcile that with my Sunday school teachings, is, you know, that thou shalt not kill, was the rumor that one would have to strip down to one's underwear in front of a nurse in order to enlist in the Marine Corps. So sorry, Lisa, that's why Sherpa is not a Marine. I distinctly remember that playground rumor that that kept me from, you know, I swore for years that I would leave Iowa, and I never did. I swore for years that I would not follow my father into a military service. And yet halfway through my college experience, Uncle Sam offered to pay my way through college, and I took it. Mm-hmm. I'm very, very proud of that service. It's been a different way to get to places that I once imagined on the playgrounds of Florida. So, you know, reconciling the thou shalt not kill. I will tell you, the one thing that was on my mind as I was preparing to deploy was, I had young kids for the first time. Mm-hmm. And not trying to play the game before you get to the stadium, but putting myself in the position, okay, what happens if my actions downrange as a member of the Army result in the loss of young life.
Right.
Whether directly or indirectly. And, you know, I'm very glad to have never pulled the trigger in anger. I think my training would have been sufficient to make sure that, you know, I would do the right thing at the right time. And I hope that my storytelling and creating opportunities for storytelling helps others reconcile their own experiences and share their own experiences in that regard.
So actually, Lisa, this is for you now. You received a Poetry of Modern Conflict Award from the Sangria Summit. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What is that award and what is it for?
Well, it's the award that the Sangria Summit is a group that helps promote, well, all kinds of writing, actually, because even science fiction and military writing and things like that. And it was actually quite a surprise because, you know, like, I'm not one to really enter very many contests. And I didn't, you know, it's something I didn't send my book to them, you know, they, or anything. I didn't even know that this was coming. It was a complete surprise to get the little email notice that they had selected my book for the Poetry of Modern Conflict Award. And so it was just like one of those things that, you know, comes out of the blue and is a very great honor to have happen.
Which book was that?
That was Permanent Change of Station.
Okay. All right. So staying with you, Lisa, you know, we spouses, we obviously experience war and deployment differently than our service members. But when I talk to people at the museum, I always say that we as a people need to view history from all sides. And so I've been through several deployments and their aftermath with both my husband and then my son. And so I've been part of that history and I've seen that conflict through a different lens, which I think adds another layer to the historical event. If that makes sense. Yes. So here, you know, and so I really liked your quote, this quote from your poem, The Night Before Deployment, because this is exactly what we're talking about. So can you read us just a little snippet and then explain what was going through your mind? And this is from your poem, The Night Before Deployment.
Yes. Yes. And here's a little snippet. But where was my training? I think of the tasks unfinished, a toy box held together with clamps, sockets without safety plugs, cabinets and drawers free to open. Our daughter will crawl and walk in the months you are gone, and I need to protect her. And at that time, my husband had just left, or was preparing to leave. And you know, it's all those things that, you know, this long list of things that you want to have done before the deployment, and all the things that a mom is worrying about, like, oh my gosh, you know, like, you know, because my husband had started building a toy box, but wasn't able to finish it. And so it's just like held together and could fall apart, you know, because it just has these like clamps on it. And my daughter's going, she was only 6 months old. And so she wasn't mobile yet to get her little fingers and the little safety plugs, but would soon be doing that, you know, and all these things I was thinking about and overwhelmed with. And I think it's, you know, like you want to have all these things done, you put them on the to-do list, but the only thing that gets done is the packing of the gear and the getting ready for deploy, you know, the Marine getting ready for deployment or the soldier getting ready for deployment or sailor. And so, you know, and I think like, you know, the things that we have the most anxiety about are the things that we really have no control about, but we obsess about with how, you know, with ways that we possibly could control them. You know, it's like, you know, I can't control what's going to happen to my husband thousands of miles away, but maybe here in the home, you know, I can keep my daughter safe. And if I could just get these things done. And luckily, this was in San Diego. This was the first deployment. So this was when my parents were a 5-hour drive away. So my dad came and helped put up the safety gate and helped, you know, I put in the little safety plugs and the sockets, but he helped with all those things that needed the power tools and things like that. And, you know, and it's just that, you know, nothing that we hope gets accomplished actually ends up getting accomplished before the deployment.
So was this the deployment where the two spouses died then? Or was it?
This was, yeah. And I actually didn't begin writing any of the poems until after they had died. And I was in this like really stress and turmoil. And so, I mean, it just brought out all those, you know, everything that I was anxious about during that time, you know. And then I kept writing because, you know, I was just like, oh, you know, it was all the things like, you know, lots of like what can go wrong. And then like coming back from the play, you know, it was just, you know, it was just a really difficult time. And, and so, yeah, so those poems are quite emotional.
Well, you know, I read a study somewhere, I can't remember where, but it does say that military spouses tend to have a lot of general anxiety as a population. And so listening to you and thinking of my own experiences, it may be true, but do you think it's true? And why or why not? Go ahead.
I would imagine it is because, I mean, for one, we get sent on these PCSs where we could be very far away from family and not have made friends yet. And we're put in these situations where we're by ourselves and we don't have, like, you know, somebody to contact if, you know, our car breaks down and we need, you know, a ride to pick it up from the dealership, you know, or something after the tow truck takes it to the dealership, you know, or, you know, and that, you know, I know whenever my husband goes away for deployment or for training, you know, anytime he's away from home for a long period of time, you know, I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm so careful when I take the stairs. Cause I'm like, well, what if I fall and I break my leg? You know, what would I do? You know, how would I, you know, what would I do if this happens? So, you know, it's just those constant, like, you know, worrying things. And then like the COVID stuff didn't help with that at all, because then, you know, that brings a whole layer of anxiety. So this last deployment that my husband went on, you know, it's like, you know, after these, because he just came back at the beginning of December. And so it's like after these years of like being cooped up with, you know, with the COVID pandemic and everything, and then he leaves for deployment. So I'm like completely anxiety driven. So like, you know, my dog, who's now considered a senior, you know, like everything, like I obsess with him constantly, like, you know, anything could like kill him, you know? And so I'm constantly worried that my dog is going to die. You know, I don't know. And it's just like, I get overwhelmed with anxiety. Yeah. And I think it's a lot of just, you know, it's that we feel like, you know, there's just so much that we can't control.
Right.
Well, military.
Well, I will tell you, I have anxieties as well. And I think part of it is the deployments and the lifestyle, but also you and I are both teachers and we are responsible for all those little people in our classrooms. And I used to, you know, be on the playground scanning to see who could get hurt. You know, I would be in my classroom. So I think being a teacher, a mom, and a military spouse is like the triple whammy of anxiety type, cautious type people.
Probably. I call my students, they're my kiddos.
Yeah.
Even exactly. Like students that are now, like, because I taught high school. And so they're like 30 some years old and I keep in touch with some of them. And I'm like, I still think of them as my kids.
Yeah, exactly. So when I was putting together our military spouse exhibit, I reached out to some current military spouses to ask them for quotes to put into the exhibit. And I was surprised at how reluctant some of them were. You know, of course, they said, go talk to public affairs. And some of the spouses agreed to talk to me only if public affairs was in the room with them. And then others would talk to me off the record, but I couldn't use their name. And so I was really surprised at how cautious they were in talking to me. And I was one of them. But I did get it. You know, you don't want to do anything that's going to, you know, draw attention. But this is like the backstory of how we got to the exhibit. So bear with me for a minute. So, you know, I reached out to a mutual acquaintance of ours, your friend, Andrea Williams, and she's with the Military Spouse Book Review. And I asked her if she knew people who would not be afraid to talk about their military experience, and maybe they would contribute a quote to the exhibit. And of course, you know, Andrea, she's lovely. And so we came up with the idea of making this into a literary exhibit. And that's how I got to know you. And 90% of all the spouses who contribute quotes and photographs are writers, and they're used to having their words out there and their opinions out there. And I know you've written all these books, these poetry books now, and some of your poems are blunt and they evoke strong emotions. And I was wondering if you're, because you're still in the military milieu, have you ever had pushback from the chain of command or other spouses for your writings?
Thankfully, I haven't, but I think it's partly because probably none of the people who would push back have ever read anything that I've written. You know what I mean? Yeah. And the people who have are most likely, you know, kind of in the same sort of mindset. Mm-hmm. And yeah, but I know why so many were scared to talk, because I wrote that first collection, Uniform, when I was going to be my MFA with the University of Alaska Anchorage. And my professor at the time, who was helping me, this was, you know, as my senior dissertation, and I'm putting together my manuscript, putting together my paper. And I had this, all these other poems that I had this manuscript planned that all I was going to do was, you know, I had all the poems written. I was just going to edit them. And that's all I was going to have to worry. And my essay, that's all I was going to have to worry about for my final year in the program. And this was during this deployment, and the spouses died, and my professor said, well, you know, why don't you write about this? And I said, because I can't. And she's like, well, why can't you? And I was like, well, I don't want to get in trouble. And I don't, you know, I don't know what people would think, you know, and I didn't want to sound whiny or sound ungrateful or sound like I was being too critical, or, you know, I had all these fears of just what people would say, or how I would be received, you know, if I would be outcasted. And then I, you know, and then I thought, you know what, I think I do need to write them, you know. Mm-hmm. And at the time I thought, well, this is, you know, who's going to see it? The people in my program, you know, the people who I'm already close to, I've gotten to know over these several years. And so I wrote the poems, and they just like came fast, because I also thought, like, how am I going to write that many, you know, enough for a whole manuscript and to be able to finish my senior dissertation. And, but they came. And then I thought, well, I'm going to be brave, and I'm going to put these out there. Mm-hmm. And it got published, and I haven't, you know, nobody has said anything like, you know, like, how dare you, or anything like that. And in fact, my husband, he's given my books to some of his bosses, Uniform, Permanent Change of Station, and Forces, and they share them with their wives. And they have actually, some of them have come back and said, like, yeah, my wife was reading it, and she just kept nodding and nodding. And so, because, and he, my husband is, you know, he, you know, some of his bosses he wouldn't have given it to and didn't, but some, you know, he knows the people that he can share my books with and would understand them and understand, like, it is, I mean, it's not that I don't like the Marine Corps and that I, you know, have anything really against it. It's just that it, even though I like it and it's our life, it doesn't mean that it's not difficult. Yeah. You know, yeah. Yeah. And I think by sharing it, you know, it makes other people hopefully think like, oh gosh, you know, I'm not the only one. Like, I thought I was terrible for thinking these things, you know, or feeling this way. And hopefully it makes people be like, okay, it's okay. I can be frustrated and it's fine.
It's a love-hate relationship.
Exactly, exactly. And that's really how a lot of relationships are, right? I mean, yeah. Yeah. Everybody 100%, 100% of the time, right? People get on your nerves at times. So, yeah.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny, and I'm just jumping, and then I got to zip in and ask Randy so we don't run out of time here. But that's why I named our first exhibit we ever did at the National Nuclear Museum Sacrifice and Service, the American Military Family. When you hear politicians talk, they always talk about the service and the sacrifice. But I put for the military family, it was the sacrifice first, you know, and then the service. And they are mutually together, but there is a lot that people don't think about when the military family is going through. I mean, the moving, everything's lost, loss of household goods and jobs and friends and moving and, you know, so there is. But getting back to Randy now, have you ever gotten in trouble for writing something in the military?
Well, and that's very interesting. Toward the end of my career as a military blogger in my off duty, once my pseudonym and secret identity had been discovered by my unit, Sherpa was tolerated. Randy and Sherpa, two different people. So Sherpa was tolerated because as sort of the, I think my sergeant major called it the sanctioned insurgency. Like Sherpa was talking about things, you know, I'm a journalist by training and by nature, so I'm not going to say anything that's going to go against operational security or personal security. And in fact, a lot of Sherpa's readers initially were spouses and family members who were saying, hey, my service member is getting home and they're dog tired and they can't talk to me, but the things that you're sharing, Sherpa, you know, let me know what's going on in their lives. Let me know. It lets me know what's going on in the training. So I started as a military blogger thinking I was going to be writing for my friends. Instead, I found I was writing for their spouses and their family members and their kids. So I never got blowback at the end of my career, but at the beginning of my career, my military career, in my first annual training, you know, the Army doesn't do anything without writing a report.
Right.
So, and we're a learning organization, you know, a lesson is knowledge acquired from experience. A lesson learned is knowledge acquired from experience that is used to change organizational or individual behavior. So we're all about learning lessons and making training better and doing better the next time and learning from mistakes. And we package these things up into what we call AARs, after action reviews or after action reports. And so at the end of my first 2 week, this is after my 6 months of Army Communication School and all that, and I was a drilling member of the Iowa Army National Guard, 2 weeks of active duty for training. And I typed up my after action report. You know, I'm a journalism major. You can't read my handwriting. I can't read my handwriting. You know, so I'm just going to type it out. So I type it out and I turn it in and it went up the chain of command to the company commander. Company commander says, hey, this is pretty high speed. Brown is typewritten. It must be good. And just staples it to his report. Everybody else's reports are hand scrawled on scraps of legal paper and all that. I think this is even before post-it notes were a thing, but it was just, you know, so, and here's this report. Well, he didn't really read it in depth because I was all cocky and young and I had used a phrase like, you know, Charlie Company would just be better if we just did it ourselves and didn't rely on the battalion because now, we were a communications company. We were Ma Bell for, you know, we were a long distance phone company for Uncle Sam. So it doesn't make any sense that Charlie Company, if you put us out in the middle of nowhere, who are we going to help? We're not going to help anybody. You know, we have to plug into a larger telephone network. Well, so the battalion commander saw this report and thought that I needed to be re-educated, I think is the term. And so I was very quickly transferred from Charlie Company to a unit 2 or 3 hours away and into the headquarters unit. And I spent most of my time in my 20 years there. I'm sorry, about 10 or 12 years before I transferred to a different type of unit, but still working in communications. At my time at that communications unit, I spent time either as an assistant or staff support, as an assistant, as an acting or as an actual, time in every single office in the battalion staff. So I was in the personnel office. I was in the operations and the logistics office. I was even for a brief moment part of the intelligence staff. Never changed my MOS or my military specialty, but I had experiences in all those things. And at one point was then put in charge of the 120 person company that all of those offices were part of. I was in charge of helping all of those offices. I was kind of like the back office support to all of those front offices.
So your re-education process took 12 years. They re-educated you for 12 years.
Well,
wow,
so
you must have really pissed him off.
So this is the ultimate irony of my career. I could not have mismanaged my career better because I had all of these experiences. I was preparing for a brigade size deployment then to Afghanistan. I knew all these people, I knew all these functions, and I had kind of that, you know, middle, not a high level or a high altitude view, but enough connection to all of these things that I could understand what I was looking at whenever I was looking at something. And so at the end of my career, the Iowa Army National Guard hired me, put me on orders during the week, my Monday through Friday job, kind of temporary, permanent, non-deployable status for 6 months, a year at a time, was to write after action reports about other units preparing to go to Iraq and Afghanistan and all that. So my career went full circle from writing a report that got me into trouble to writing reports that hopefully helped people make better decisions about their training and their deployment. And now, after I'm retired as a citizen soldier, and maybe in a hopefully more literary and entertaining sense, writing stories and reports of military service. So it all comes around, I guess is what I'm saying.
Speaking of coming around, this is for either or both of you. How did you guys meet? You live at opposite ends of the country. So how did you guys meet initially? And then I wanted to ask Lisa, because we're running out of time here. Middle West Press published at least one of your books. What made you go with them as a publisher? But so how did you meet? And then Lisa, why did you choose them?
I think we met, Lisa, correct me if I'm wrong. We met at AWP, Association of American Writing Programs. Is that right?
Yes.
The acronym doesn't quite work, but
it's missing a letter.
It's missing an A. The other A is silent. But we met at Minneapolis, I think, in 2015. That was our first face to face, and we met at the booth that run by Abby E. Murray, another great war poet and military spouse and a great American.
She does some work with us. Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Her latest poetry collection, Hail and Farewell, also speaks to the military spouse experience. And you're asking about blowback. You might read some words there too. You and Abby were staffing the Collateral Journal.
Mm-hmm.
The Collateral Journal is a great publication. It's still being run out there. It's all about military experience from everybody else's experiences other than the service members.
Right.
I think I've captured that. Okay. And y'all were giving away collateral. We're not on video right now, but I'm holding up the little green and tan army men with Collateral Journal tags on them. In fact, I still have them. You can see them in back by the R2-D2 unit. And I got, I think that was my first Army man since Satellite Beach, Florida. And I got a communications guy with a radio. And that's the first time that Lisa Stice and Randy slash Sherpa met, I believe.
Yeah, and the picture from that meeting that Andrea took of me sitting at that table with the little army men is the picture for the back cover of my books published with Middle
West.
You
are correct. If you look with a magnifying glass, you can actually see the little green army men.
So Lisa, what drew you to publish with them?
Well, for one, I mean, being a niche poet, you know, it's nice to find a press that probably gets you because, you know, they're publishing the kind of stuff that you write, mm-hmm. you know, so that was really exciting. And also, you know, I think, you know, when a writer selects a press, you have to respect the work that's coming out of there, mm-hmm. That's produced before you. And I really respected the writing that Middle West Press was producing and publishing. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to see what happens and send them a manuscript. And so that's how Permanent Change of Station came about. And then, you know, it was such a great experience, you know, again, like a press that, well, for one, is small and so is able to work on a more individual basis with the writer is a fantastic feeling. And a press that gets your writing. So, you know, I really felt like, you know, with Permanent Change of Station, my poems that are near and dear to me were treated with a lot of care and respect. Right. And I really appreciated that. And so that's why I came to Middle West Press again with another manuscript, and that was Forces.
That's cool. So, and you know, you talk about they get you in small press, and that's awesome.
Yeah.
So Middle West Press publishes several military-themed books a year, and Randy has sent me several of their recent ones. How can writers in our audience that are listening today find out more about what you're looking for and what the submission process is?
Okay, well, the MiddleWestPress.com is the best place to find what we're doing and what we're looking for. There's a link to an application called Submittable that is in under a tab that says About Our Press. Right now, we are open to poetry collections, military-themed poetry collections by an individual author. Mm-hmm. And we're also, Lisa and I are working together officially on our first collaboration. It was based on an idea by another, by a fellow Army veteran, Vicki Hudson. Mm-hmm. We are soliciting extremely short stories, like less than 300 words, or poems that are inspired by military equipment. And this is for both veterans and family members and service members. But we feel that we're calling them micro stories, but these could be like prose poems or flash fiction or, like, I don't know, interpretive dance, you know.
Like military equipment, like tanks or like.
Well, we were thinking more like, you know, helmets and belt buckles and challenge coins and, you know, things you have, you know, why do I still have this in my dresser drawer, kinds of medals. Abby Murray made us think of, she's got a couple of great poems about formal dresses that she's had to purchase in for the Army birthday ball or whatever. Right. You know, the military is full of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And we think that it'd be a great, because I'm still trying to get rid of it. I still, you know, my wife told me to get it down to one footlocker and I did, but somehow it keeps growing. You know, so we think it's a really great prompt, and Vicky's going to work with us later on the year. So we're very much looking forward to that. But so that call for submissions is up either through Submittable or at MiddleWestPress.com. But, you know, we're a very small operation. We started in poetry because, you know, poetry business is like military intelligence. It's a contradiction in terms. Nobody expects to make any money in poetry. We just want to do good work and get good stuff out there and change the world by changing people's minds about what the military's experience is all about. So,
well, let me tell you, starting a nonprofit never means that you're going to make money either.
Well, exactly, and that's the one thing that's you know, we're not able to accept grant money because we aren't a nonprofit. We're still a sole proprietor LLC based upon my original, you know, freelance writing and editing business. That's, you know, yeah. But we are, we're not, I guess my, and Lisa's heard this before, we don't hope to make a lot of money. We just hope not to lose a lot of money on poetry.
Okay, with that, I'll just go right into Lisa. So congratulations to you on becoming the associate editor for Middle West Press that you hope you're not going to lose any money on. what does that entail?
Well, hopefully I help meet that goal of not losing money. Well, the first is the anthology that we're collaborating on and some future similar projects of other anthologies and things like that. So,
yeah, Lisa and I are both very cognizant of the fact that the poetry community is very ivory tower and is very white. And we know that part of that is or part of the solution to that is educating people that poetry collections are actually a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we know, you know, I work with a nonprofit called Military Experience in the Arts, and we do a good job there of and other associations such as Warrior Writers and a couple of other international organizations do a good job of evangelizing to veterans and family members that they have a voice and they have something to say, and helping them kind of get to those first one or two poems, and hopefully they have good experience in publishing and then sharing them. And then, you know, there is an evolution that can take place, and suddenly you can be somebody like Lisa who has an experience that suddenly generates a lot of work, and that work needs to have a space to get out there. And yes, war poetry, modern war poetry, is a niche of a niche of a niche.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I hope for some people too, and hope people realize that poetry doesn't have to be, you know, complicated, and poetry can be funny, you know, and poetry can be accessible and still be really great poetry, you know, like, and I think it's better than those ones that you read and get to the bottom of and like, oh, it sounded cool, but it didn't, you know, I don't know what it's about, you know,
right.
You know, Middle West Press, I feel like all of, you know, it's all like, you know what it's about, and it touches you because it's like, it's just like people's truths and people speaking their hearts. And like Randy said, like, you know, changing people's minds and, you know.
Yeah. So when you go to our call us for submissions, you'll see we're very hungry for narratives from service members and veterans who identify as women. We're very hungry for narratives from poets of color, or from the queer communities, or, you know, whatever, you know, experiences other than ours, because those voices, you know, really have not been put into a form that you can put into a library.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to do with Middle West Press.
So very
one of the things we're trying to do.
So very quickly, Randy and Lisa. So I have poets that I'm sure are going to listen to this and they're going to say, oh, I can submit. If it's been published before, are you still allowed to submit for your anthologies?
Yeah, yes. The technical language is we are open for new and reprint materials.
Okay.
We do ask the authors to validate that they retain copyright. Copyright reverts to them after, you know, we're just looking for anthology rights to their work. And then for the individual poetry collection, it's poetic practice to, you know, submit poems and get them published in literary journals, and we then credit those literary journals where they first appeared. But, you know, a poetry collection of, what would you say, Lisa, 50 or more poems would be a poetry collection, and maybe
I would say
no more than 25 would be a poetry chapbook.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, typically practice is when you're creating a manuscript and submitting it to a literary press, you know, to include Middle West Press, you know, maybe anywhere from 1% to 50% of that manuscript may have been published elsewhere.
Okay. Well, that's good.
To know. It's okay. Yeah.
It's good to know, because I know that I have written poetry and I've published it on my blog, and I never knew if that counted as publication or not.
And that can vary by call for submission, but you know, it is good to know. Some presses count publishing on a blog or Facebook or whatever as prior publishing. Either way, we're very interested, Lisa and I, in the,
the
anthology project. Excellent. Okay. Appreciate it.
So in the next few minutes that we have left, is there something I should have asked but didn't? Does anybody have anything that I should have asked you?
Wow. Oh, this has been wonderful. This is covered ground I've never been asked in an interview before. This is great.
I do my homework.
Can't wait. My wife and I have been trying to figure out. My folks are now down in Arizona. We've been trying to figure out how to visit Arizona through New Mexico. So we can't wait to. We've got a little pin on the map. We want to come find y'all.
Well, isn't it just straight down and over? No, Iowa's over here. Yeah, no. Okay, so you're going to have to make like a V instead of a L.
It's been done. I know. And we've got another Middle West Press author alumni, our alumnus in your area, our Coast Guard poet, Benjamin B. White, who published Always Ready, is down that way. So we'd love to come visit him as well.
Well, awesome. We'd love to have you. Hey, so I just thought of something to ask, Randy. Mm-hmm. Why is your pseudonym Charlie Sherpa?
Completely uninteresting story. My nickname in the Guard was Sherpa because somebody, you know, remember I was a support for a lot of different offices and officers. And so one annual training, I was dispatched to go around and collect everybody's sidearm and rifle because it was time to go home. And the guys and gals in the arms room needed those. So I was a trusted person, and I could go around and collect everybody's weapon and turn it in. They don't give you when they handed over the weapon, they didn't hand over their holsters and their slings and all that kind of stuff. So I was I was slinging stuff and putting things into cargo pockets, and I must have had, you know, 6 to 10 different weapons on me, and I looked like the warthog from hell kind of thing. And somebody said, "Oh, you're the weapons Sherpa," and so that's where that. And then when I started a blog, I needed a first name, and so Charlie came to mind, and so Charlie Sherpa was born, and that's what it's all about. It's the Sherpa name. I wear it proudly. If somebody calls me, and I still go by Sherpa at conferences, particularly because it's like being in the Army. Somebody yells your rank, you know exactly that they're coming to you from a military-facing identity. And so Sherpa still continues to be a useful person to keep around. So.
There you go. Well, thank you for clarifying that. So could I ask each of you to read a poem in closing? And Randy, I really, because you are a brat, and we have not talked enough about the brathood of you. So I think Airman Second Grade would really resonate with all our brat listeners out there. So if you could read that, I would.
Yeah.
Okay.
That would be great. I've got that one. That was actually picked up through the Veterans Writing Project at one point, and then it got reprinted in a magazine called Friction. And they did such a lovely job with it. They got like a comic book artist to illustrate the poem that I did the equivalent of putting it on my own refrigerator in my office, and so I get to look at that every day. But that poem speaks to kind of. You know, my brother and I felt lucky that we got pulled out and replanted a couple of times, and we learned how to meet people and see new places and that. Mm-mm. That's looking back. At the time, it felt very isolating and very lonely, and I wasn't old enough in second grade to realize that there's different vernacular in the military. And regionally. So I would always say that, well, why are you, you know, when people would ask, well, kid, why are you moving so much? Well, we're in the military. And the in part of that sentence people would react to, well, you're not in the military. You're only in second grade.
Oh, see, that makes perfect sense to me. Okay. So read your poem.
Okay. So that's where this poem is coming from.
Okay.
Airman, second grade. This is where you ask me where I'm from. And this is where I tell you that my family and I are in the Air Force. focused as a death ray lens on the playground ants below, you blaze suddenly that my pants are on fire. I do not understand why. I know some hard things, just as the sky is blue. My family is in the Air Force. I have already moved 4 times that I can remember. Each address has been a new bicycle and learning to pedal through conversations like this one. Kids can't be in the Air Force, you laugh. I burn, my face hot, my eyes sting. But I get it now. I am not from around here, and you are not one of us.
Wow. Yeah. So true. Wow.
Thanks for letting me read that one. That's the first time I've read that one to an audience.
Oh, well, I think so many people will relate to that one. So I'm going to close now. And then afterwards, Lisa will send us off with her poem. And so I needed to thank all of our sponsors and to remind our listeners that this podcast is brought to you by the Museum of the American Military Family and Learning Center. And the museum's podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, and organizations like Military Brat Seal and Military Brats Registry. And I wanted to thank our guests, Lisa Stice and Randy Brown, for coming on today. It's absolutely been great. And we are so far over time, but it's been wonderful. So Lisa, send us off with your poem. What are you going to read?
I think I'll read Headstrong, because we talked about, you know, that fear of like talking and letting our feelings out. And that's really what this poem is all about. And so I think it'll be the perfect one.
Okay.
Alrighty. Headstrong. I'm sorry. Catches in the throat and bruises in that wavering hesitation like a rock falling back to earth. See how it curves under the skin, twists and cuts as it hugs the voice box. I forgive, sways like a tamarack, hackmatack, red larch, juniper, larix laricina of the lowlands, with roots in cool mud and branches in the soft air where we hold the belief we are stronger than wind. The end is as blue as slag and twice as worthless. This is where I say I never meant it. And this is where you say it doesn't matter anymore, because words are less than clouds and leaves and stone.
Wow. Interesting. Wow. Headstrong.
Yes. It's in Forces.
All right. Well, I will put the links to your website, Lisa, and also to Middle West Press at the bottom of our notes. And I wanted to thank you guys, leaving us with poetry today. That's been a wonderful way to end our February cold morning. So thank you so much for coming, and I wish you all the best, and I will be posting this shortly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cersei.
Bye.
Bye now.
Bye.